if there's anything I think about on a daily basis, it's like, what a depressing place to come to as a human species, that we are afraid of each other or that we're uncomfortable around each other. And so we retreat in ways that make us have less robust lives and allow a lot of people in our communities to feel unwelcome or unsafe. All of us are made smaller by the fear of really thoughtful and intentional community engagement.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucy Chappell. UK High Court upholds ban on pediatric gender-affirming healthcare. Nepali trans woman wins female ID papers without surgery. And the devil's in the DEI details. Those stories and more this week because you found This Way Out.
I'm Joe Bainline.
And I'm Melanie Keller.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending August 3rd, 2024. The UK's ban on puberty blockers for pediatric gender-affirming healthcare passes legal muster, according to High Court Judge Beverly Lang. Her ruling this week upholds the policy currently in effect in England, Wales, and Scotland. It was initiated by the outgoing Tory government, but the newly elected Labour government fully supports the ban. That notably includes the gay incoming Health Minister Wes Streeting, who has said he wants to make the temporary emergency order permanent. The nonprofit advocacy group TransActual and the Good Law Project represented an unnamed plaintiff. Their lawsuit claimed that the policy directive issued by the Tory Health Minister Victoria Atkins exceeded the powers of that office. Judge Lang disagreed. She wrote, "In my view, it was rational for Atkins to decide that it was essential to adopt the emergency procedure to avoid serious danger to the health of children and young people who would otherwise be prescribed puberty blockers during that 5 to 6 month period." However, what Lang calls a rational decision may have been based on irrational information. The puberty blocker ban was issued shortly after the publication of the highly controversial CAS report. Its review of pediatric gender-affirming healthcare concluded that treating trans young people with reversible puberty blockers was a serious threat to their health and well-being. The British Medical Association became the latest to question the CAS report's scientific validity, as the group expressed disappointment in the High Court ruling. The largest doctors' union in the UK is calling for a thorough review of what the organization charges are the CAS report's unsubstantiated findings.
Despite, or maybe because of, the controversy, London Trans Plus Pride broke records with close to 60,000 people marching on July 27th. Drag stars, actors, and politicians could be spotted among the throngs as the sixth annual procession wound its way through the streets of the English capital. London Trans Plus Pride co-founder Lewis G. Burton's celebratory statement summed it up, saying, in part, "Often, due to vitriol and bigotry inflated by the UK media that our community faces, we feel we live in a country where we are not loved and respected. Yesterday was a beautiful reminder to not only the glorious Trans Plus community, but to London, the new Labour government, and the rest of the world that Trans Plus people are loved. And this love is a huge majority."
A Nepali law student and human rights activist will be able to change her legal gender to female without having to undergo gender-affirming surgery. The landmark ruling issued by the nation's highest court this week applies only to the plaintiff. Trans people have been able to self-identify as other or third gender on their government documents for more than a decade. The legal barriers for choosing the male or female option are more onerous. Surgery is required and usually must be done outside the country. That's followed by official genital examinations and intrusive medical assessments back home. Those rules remain in place for every other trans person in Nepal who wants to identify as M or F on their government documents, except for Rakshana Kapali. The 27-year-old plaintiff has filed suit dozens of times on behalf of transgender and intersex people since 2021. She told the Himalayan Times, "My life is going to be easy from now on." Everyone else will still need to petition the court to choose M or F without the mandatory surgery.
LGBTQ students in the U.S. saw their protections affirmed one day and stripped the next. On July 30th, Trump appointed Birmingham, Alabama District Judge Anne Marie Axon ruled in favor of the Biden administration's policy, including sexual orientation and gender identity bias prohibitions under Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972. On July 31st, the Atlanta-based 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals upheld the temporary injunction Judge Axon had refused to quash. This lawsuit was filed by officials in Alabama, Florida, Georgia, and South Carolina. Attorneys from more than two dozen Republican-controlled U.S. states have succeeded in temporarily blocking enforcement of that Education Department policy. They insist that the word sex in Title IX is defined only as biological. The Department of Education announced the inclusive policy in April. As of now, it can only enforce it in 24 of the 50 U.S. states. The department issued a statement in response to the latest setback, insisting, "We will continue to fight for every student."
Nebraska can prevent trans patients under the age of 19 from getting gender-affirming health care. The state Supreme Court has upheld that and another provision of the same law that prohibits most abortions after the first 12 weeks of pregnancy. The 6-1 August 2nd ruling rejected the argument of plaintiffs represented by the American Civil Liberties Union and others. They claimed that the Republican-dominated legislature's Bill 574 violates the state constitution by dealing with more than one issue. The justices decided that both provisions involve the single issue of health care. The lone dissenter was Justice Lindsay Miller Lerman. She said her colleagues had given deference to lawmakers at the expense of the Constitution. In her opinion, unrelated provisions that happen to do similar things at some level of generality do not dispel the criticism that the bill contains more than one subject. Expect the issue of pediatric gender-affirming health care to wind up at the U.S. Supreme Court. ACLU of Nebraska Executive Director Mindy Rush Chipman says a variety of options are under consideration. She vowed, "This case will not be the final word on abortion access and the rights of trans youth and their families in Nebraska. Despite this loss, we will continue to do all that we can to ensure that Nebraskans can make their own private decisions about their lives, families, and futures."
Finally, a transgender Christian IT specialist is storming the gates of an infamous far-right Christian institution. Eleanor Zinsky was fired a month after she came out to human resources at Liberty University. The ACLU is representing Zinsky in what appears to be an open and shut case on its face. It claims that Liberty officials actually read a statement to her explaining that she was being terminated for denying biological and chromosomal sex assigned at birth. She was told that was in conflict with the university's doctrinal statement, in which denial of birth sex by self-identification with a different gender is called a sinful act prohibited by God. The university was founded in Lynchburg, Virginia, by the late televangelist Jerry Falwell, who led the anti-queer Moral Majority in the 1980s. His son and successor's scandalous exit from the institution ended with a surprise settlement announced last week. Zinsky's lawsuit seeks $300,000 in compensatory damages and declaratory relief that Liberty University's policy violates federal anti-discrimination laws. A regular congregant at a welcoming Episcopal church, Zinsky's personal testimony is simple. "Christianity has been so weaponized against the LGBTQ community, but there doesn't need to be a conflict. You can be transgender and Christian. I am."
That's News Wrap, Global Queer News with Attitude, for the week ending August 3rd, 2024. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappell, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Joe Bainline. Stay healthy.
And I'm Melanie Keller. Stay safe.
In my mind, I'm gone to Carolina. Can't you just see the sunshine? Can't you just feel the moonshine? And ain't it just like a friend of mine to hit me from behind? When I'm gone to Carolina, in my mind.
This is Dorothy Allison, author of Bastard Out of Carolina and numerous trashy pieces. You're listening to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
How do you define DEI? Go ahead. How do you define
diversity, equity, inclusion?
Okay, yeah. Go ahead. Is that what your definition?
That is.
Give me a definition then. Would you give me a definition
DEI.
Of that? Give me a definition.
Sir,
of that.
I'm asking you a question.
No, you
very
have to define
question.
It. Define it for me, if you.
I just defined it, sir.
Walking in someone else's shoes, seeing it from a different view, learning to appreciate. Our differences for the better. So much more than our backgrounds. Deeper than a you or a pronoun. As unique as you are, you yourself are strong. Bring the change, put the work in. Let's bring the change, gotta put the work in.
U.S. colleges and universities are flunking their diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, if you ask right-wing politicians and pundits. DEI efforts look different from inside the halls of Ivy, where most students, faculty, and staff value a campus environment that's welcoming for everyone. The subject is ripe for study, so it's back to school for This Way Out's David Hunt, whose thesis is that the current conflict signals hope for the future.
Something's always worrying right-wing media. Remember the panic over critical race theory? That's the framework some college courses apply to the study of social, political, and economic institutions. As the right framed it, critical race theory threatened to poison the minds of the nation's third graders. The problem, of course, is that hardly anyone actually applies critical race theory in the real world. Not so DEI. Diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI, is everywhere, and that makes it a much better target for right-wing angst.
The only reason Kamala's in the White House is because of the DEI deal Biden cut with Bernie to seal the nomination.
And of course, her whole history is DEI, diversity, exclusion, and equity.
I think she was a DEI hire.
She would be the queen of DEI if she were elected. She is DEI.
100%. She was a DEI hire.
I'm David Hunt. To hear my conservative friends tell it, DEI isn't leveling the playing field for everyone. It's hurting people like me, white middle-class professionals, whose jobs, promotions, and raises are going to others, people they characterize as diversity hires. Don't worry, I'm doing fine. And I'm not alone. In fact, in the first quarter of 2024, the unemployment rate for white workers was just 3.1%. For blacks, it was almost double that, 6%. If DEI has done anything, it's helped companies become more adaptable in a changing world. That's according to a 2023 study by Bain & Company. Adaptability, in turn, results in better revenue growth, shareholder return, and EBIT margins, according to Bain. EBIT stands for Earnings Before Interest and Taxes, and it's used to measure a company's profitability. The bottom line? Companies that are more diverse and welcoming adapt better to change and are more profitable. DEI is a good thing. But the perception among conservatives is much different, thanks to the constant barrage of anti-diversity messages on the right. Only 30% of Republican workers say DEI is a good thing, according to Pew Research. And only 7% value working with LGBTQ colleagues. And so DEI is quickly losing support among leaders in business, industry, and notably higher education. For example, in the University of North Carolina system, where I worked for more than a decade, the conservative Board of Governors has mandated that DEI efforts refrain from what it calls administrative activism on behalf of social and political causes. Anti-racism is out. Neutrality is in. What does neutrality look like in higher education? It's not pretty, but it's not new. In 2015, when I was a senior editor at North Carolina State University, I wrote an article for the school's research magazine about the discovery of a 1962 recording of a speech by Martin Luther King Jr. in Rocky Mount, North Carolina. It was the first time King had used the words, "I have a dream," to describe his vision of a just society. In the first draft of my article, I wrote, "Rocky Mount, like cities throughout the South, enforced the shameful segregation laws of the Jim Crow era." A research administrator deleted the word shameful. The backlash against DEI is playing out at colleges and universities across the U.S. The Chronicle of Higher Education began tracking what it calls the dismantling of DEI in July. Within a few weeks, the publication had tracked policy changes at 185 college campuses in 25 states. Schools in Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Iowa, Oklahoma, and Texas, to name a few, have closed down diversity programs and offices. Other states, including Georgia and Tennessee, have ended mandatory diversity training. Penn State closed its Multicultural Resource Center. The University of Wisconsin at Madison ended a program to recruit diverse faculty. You get the idea.
One day we will look back and remember times like that. It will taste an even sweeter, but the past remains the past. But the past remains the past.
To find a silver lining in this trend, I reached out to Renee Wells, Assistant Vice President for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at Queen's University of Charlotte in North Carolina. I met Wells when she served as director of the LGBTQ Pride Center at NC State. It turns out she hasn't given up on higher education, despite the challenges. She explains.
I love, love, love working in a field, higher ed, that refuses to give up on the future. Like, that is what we do. We prepare people to go into the world, not just to work, but to be part of communities and to think about the problems that we face collectively and how we move forward in addressing them together in ways that make the world a better place, make our communities a better place.
How do you describe the work you do in DEI?
I don't see DEI as separate work. I see it as language we've developed that kind of encapsulates often really specific initiatives and outcomes, but fundamentally at the root, what we're really trying to do is to foster a space. And that space is robust in a college and university setting because it's the classroom, it's the residence hall, it's the dining hall, it's all the student organization spaces, it's athletics teams. It's all of these environments that we're inviting students into, that we're sharing with them as faculty and staff. We want those spaces to be spaces where students can grow in, can learn in, right? Because a lot of students come into higher ed and they're nervous. They're nervous about coming from a small town anywhere and encountering people they've never met before. And sometimes they're nervous about like what to say and what to do and what to ask and what to talk about. And it's developmental and it's just also, it's new and exciting, but also a little intimidating. And college is a space that tries to carve out environments to help make that easier for folks.
You are listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm David Hunt, continuing my conversation with Renee Wells on the dismantling of diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts in higher education and beyond. Wells is the Chief Diversity Officer at Queen's University of Charlotte in North Carolina. Since Queen's is a private institution, it doesn't have to enact policies mandated by the public University of North Carolina system. I asked Wells how her colleagues across higher education are dealing with the growing pressure to roll back diversity initiatives.
As a whole, higher ed has largely shifted internally to places that tend to understand the importance of this work as it relates to student success, to employee retention, to just fostering a community that thrives. And so doing this work in the context of higher ed is different because now you have folks inside colleges and universities worrying about their students and worrying about their colleagues in ways that they understand very clearly now the implications of some of the external pressures in ways that they know are going to negatively impact student success, well-being, retention, et cetera. So it's a time where there's also a lot of shared anxiety about what kind of community we're able to be.
How do you respond to the idea that institutions should be viewpoint neutral?
Well, I mean, here's the thing. If you say we can't talk about race or ethnicity or sexuality or documentation status or disability or any of these things because we need to be neutral, we are, in fact, not being neutral. What we're saying is that these are things we are choosing to say are things that we cannot and should not and will not, you know, engage critically around. And they are all the things that make up every human being that lives in our society. So there's a way in which there is absolutely nothing neutral happening. The discomfort with whatever the root of discomfort and resistance to DEI is, and we could talk for days about what many of those roots might be, really gets in the way of us developing as like fuller and richer human beings who are able to move through the world in ways that allows us to grow. And it's not just that it causes harm to people who've often experienced a lot of spaces that don't feel safe or where they don't feel welcome or they don't feel valued. All of us are made smaller by the fear of really thoughtful and intentional community engagement. And, you know, I think if there's anything I think about on a daily basis, it's like, what a depressing place to come to as a human species, that we are afraid of each other or that we're uncomfortable around each other. And so we retreat in ways that make us have less robust lives and allow a lot of people in our communities to feel unwelcome or unsafe. And it's a really, really, really sad world to raise children into, who are then maybe less caring and compassionate and less focused on trying to work in community with others to make a world where everybody can thrive.
Do you have advice for people in institutions who are facing a backlash against DEI? For people who want to continue creating welcoming, thriving, healthy communities, schools, and workplaces?
If we make it about community and about relationships, it makes it much more like grounded in what we do and all the spaces we navigate. No one goes into a learning environment without an understanding that there's a classroom full of students and that they're going to interact with each other. And rather than putting a bunch of language on top of that, just say, what are the dynamics we want to have in this room as we learn together? And how do we do that? So, you know, I think in the end, DEI actually should be something that we all want, because ultimately it is about what are the relationships that are healthy and productive in shared spaces, and what are the skills that allow us to have those relationships with each other. And so the thing about communal spaces is that we get so much more out of them when we're really thoughtfully engaging with each other. And we only thoughtfully engage with each other when we're invited to do so. And the space where that happens is actually responsive, and what we are each contributing is valued. And then it becomes much more nuanced. And so, you know, you might have institutions right now that are populated with people who maybe don't care or who feel pressured not to care. But, you know, in the background, like, a lot of people care. A lot of people are finding ways to make sure that those around them feel cared for, and that we're raising generations who know how to care for each other. And so, like, you know, the pendulum is a lot of things, but it's also understanding that as people go out into the world and they become future social workers and future educators and future everything, we're sending people out in the world who care.
On a practical level, institutions, including many colleges and universities, have spent the better part of two decades promoting diversity, equity, and inclusion as organizational values, core values. And the people working in those institutions have largely supported those efforts and embraced those values. Dismantling DEI may end some programs, curtail some opportunities, or those programs and opportunities may simply be rebranded and continue as ever. What's certain is that institutions bowing to pressure from the right and turning away from values they once extolled are sure to lose the trust of the very people responsible for their success or failure. And let's not be afraid to say it. That's shameful. I'd like to thank my guest, Renee Wells, Assistant Vice President for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at Queen's University of Charlotte in North Carolina. For This Way Out, I'm David Hunt.
And again, Christians, get out and vote just this time. In 4 years, you don't have to vote again. We'll have it fixed so good you're not going to have to vote.
So he won't debate. But he and his running mate sure seem to have a lot to say about me. Well, Donald, I do hope you'll reconsider to meet me on the debate stage. Because as the saying goes, if you've got something to say,
thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. NewsWrap was reported this week by Joe Bainline and Melanie Keller and produced by Brian DeShazer. Our correspondent was David Hunt. You heard music by Rachel Berenger, War, Autumn Nicholas, Zemo, and Eldar Kadem. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Hal Myers of Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappelle. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And on 2MC Bathurst, New South Wales, KXSU Seattle, Washington, WADR Janesville, Wisconsin, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned, y'all.